Hello, 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 and welcome back, or welcome for the very first time to Infectious, a podcast all about infectious diseases. My name is Adriana Paiero, and I will be your wonderful host for this little journey today. And you might be asking, what are we going to be covering this episode? And the answer is a tiny little ectoparasitic infection of the skin caused by the mites or Coptis scabii, better known as scabies. Another one of our dear friends officially recognized as a neglected tropical disease in 2009 by the World Health Organization. Because I've had some trouble getting these out on any level of a regular basis, because I love to put so much detail into each disease, I've decided to switch up the format a bit. So moving forward, I'm going to split these episodes into multiple parts. So instead of getting one super, super long episode that covers everything from start to finish, I'll be touching on the organism, the clinical manifestations, the epidemiology, the history, and then finally the treatment and prevention as separate episodes. I'm really hoping that by splitting these up, I can provide content on a more regular basis, because each part alone is just quite a bit of work to put together in a way that I can really be proud of. But anyways, back to the episode and our disease of choice, scabies. So get ready to learn all about the cause of one of the absolute worst itches people experience in their entire life. An infection so common it has its own subreddit. And more specifically today, we'll be exploring the man behind the madness, the tiny, almost microscopic bug able to infiltrate into our body, build its home amongst our discarded skin layers, and move between us without us even knowing. So let's get into the big, the bad, and the itchy. For episode 5, Scabies, part 1. So first, before we dive into what scabies is, let's just get a quick overview of the disease itself. Scabies is referred to by many nicknames, including itch mite, seven-year itch, or mange in our furry little friends. Scabies is the nickname given to the skin condition that results due to infestation by a type of tiny mite known as Cercoptes scabii var hominins. While this mite is closely related to other species that are able to affect other animals, such as cats, dogs, pigs, and horses, interspecies spread is normally self-limited. A very, very good thing. The name for the disease scabies comes from the Latin word scabere, which means to scratch. And from all of its other names that I've listed, it must slowly be becoming clearer that this condition is one where the skin of an animal or human host is colonized by the mite, and it causes a particularly distinctive rash and itch. One that is so bad that it is truly torturous to some people. Classic scabies typically manifest as an intensely itchy rash, normally located on the webs of the fingers, wrists, armpits, nipples, and genitalia, while crescent scabies is a much, much less common, but much worse variant. The diagnosis of scabies is confirmed through detection of the scabies mites, eggs, or feces, and that's why we are going to learn a little bit more about that mite today. So, on to our mite. Scabies is part of the arthropod class, Arachnida, subclass Acari, family, Cercopididae, which, yes, means they are related to spiders.
Stinky spiders.
But more specifically, mites are tiny arachnids that are most closely related to ticks, with many types that live in the soil and a number that are parasitic to plants or animals. And just to clarify, I'm not saying that scabies mites live in all of these environments, but rather that mites in general, so the family that scabies is part of, can live in all of these different places. Some other types of mites include cheese mites, an essential component of making Cantal and Mimolette cheeses, epidermopedites, another disease-causing bugger who loves damp, warm areas of the skin, specifically regarded as nostril specialists in birds and mammals. And finally, dust mites, a well-known irritant that results in asthma or allergies in many. Generally, though, creatures in the mite family share some very similar characteristics. First of all, mites are by definition some of the smallest of the bug world and are so tiny they often cannot be easily seen with the naked eye. Next, as they are part of the subclass Arachnida, all of them have 8 legs when they are in their adult form. Finally, another really interesting component of the mites is that they're often part of the decomposition cycle of life, consuming matter that is decaying, well, the majority of the time. As well, because of this role, they can be found almost everywhere in Earth. That's including water, soil, forests, pastures, thermal springs, and, well, also eating our skin. But now that we know more about the family of our Cercoptes scabii mite, let's talk more about the current mite of interest. So, first touching on their appearance. Scabies mites, similar to other mite species, are nearly invisible to the naked eye. The females are approximately 0.3 to 0.45 millimeters long, while the males are approximately two-thirds to half the size, at 0.20 to 0.24 millimeters. And thinking about that size of the female, that's going to be approximately the size of a grain of salt. So yes, very, very, very small. Appearance-wise, once you can actually see them under a microscope, these guys are pearly white, eyeless, because, you know, they live under our skin, so they don't really need them down there. As well, they're translucent, small, oval, and flattened in appearance. Each mite has 8 legs attached to the underside of their belly, kind of like a turtle, with 2 horny primary pairs of legs bearing 2 claws each. And what I really think is one of their weirdest features is that along their back are these weird little spikes that I couldn't figure out what the purpose of them were, but they are very, very characteristic. These are definitely not very attractive animals, but they are actually pretty cool looking. And I'll post some pictures of electron microscopy as well as regular light microscopy so you can see what they look like as well. And that'll be probably on my Instagram or Twitter. So, knowing what scabies mites are, you might be asking yourself,
why are they attacking humans?
Scabies mites are actually obligate human skin parasites, which means that they cannot replicate or survive outside of the human host. This also means that, yes, this bucker spends his life playing Minecraft through the upper skin layer and never dives deeper than the epidermis, which is the outermost layer of skin, which consists of predominantly dead cells. But why exactly do they need us when all of their relatives seem to do pretty fine without having another animal be their primary source of food and nutrition? First of all, the scabies mite is highly adaptive to humans, which means that they can't produce without us. And this will make more sense when I touch on their life cycle in the next section in this. In addition, we are their source of food and water. That means without humans, they will both starve as well as become so dehydrated they will die. This dehydration comes as a fact that scabies mites, unlike other mites and tick species, are completely unable to maintain their water balance without ingesting human lymph. This is a huge diversion from their close relatives, who are able to actually absorb water from the unsaturated ambient air that surrounds them. This means that they can basically drink through their skin, which is pretty cool. Unfortunately, scabies mites just somehow got rid of this very, very specific skill. And when they're placed in completely saturated ambient air, meaning that the air is basically 97.5% water, so very, very high humidity, they'll still completely dehydrate. This means that if they leave us, they're going to die relatively quickly.
When I was editing this podcast, this part made me ask a very important question that I initially actually left out. How did this co-evolution happen? Specifically, how did the mites specialize to infect humans when it can also infect so many other creatures? Did the mite evolve to, you know, infect dogs and then co-adapt to humans? Or which way did this transfer happen? When I looked at it in the literature, it seems that currently, the ancestral origin of the scabies mite that parasitizes humans and many families of mammals is not really known. Likewise, how long ago the coevolution of S. scabii with specific host animals began and how this has evolved over time is also unknown. But for me, that wasn't really enough, so I looked a little bit deeper. And I found one paper that was published by a set of veterinarians that had talked a bit about this debate, which is the quote-unquote not validated but current scientific consensus on how this occurred. It's currently believed that Cercoptes mites actually initially evolved in humans, or our proto-human ancestors, which makes us actually the initial host of the species. If you're now wondering, well, when the dogs or other animals get the mange that we now see in them, the answer is once again, because they made the horrible decision to become friends with humans, or more so, to be domesticated by us. Currently, it's hypothesized that as humans domesticated various species of animals, which dogs are probably one of the first ones, with it happening about 14,000 years ago, behavioral transmission likely occurred. This means that transmission happened between humans and animals, and these half-domesticated dogs then likely escaped and transmitted it back to the wild animal population. Or at least that's the working theory. Recognizing that domestication per se tends to reduce immunocompetence, domesticated animals may have been more susceptible to infection, increasing the probability of mites adapting to the new host as it gets transferred between the different domesticated animals and then they escape and rummage around with their wild counterparts. I know, so cool. Therefore, our smart idea to domesticate animals led to scabies in these wild populations, so take that as a fun fact with you and do as you must, but mange is really another fault of humanity. In this final part, when I was looking at the mites, I was really interested in the aspect of how much it actually affects a host to harbor them, thinking about how many parasitic infections actually take a lot of energy from those who are infected, which can modify their behavior and injure them in some way. What's really interesting, though, is unlike other parasites, these mites don't seem to actually have a massive effect on humans. I mean, after you discount the whole impracticality of being super itchy and not being able to sleep and how bad this infection actually is. Rather, though, when they've done calculations on rabbits to show how much energy the mites actually drain from them, it's minimal and almost unmeasurable at best. So yes, while these guys are definitely unwanted neighbors, they're not going to kill you, which is actually probably a good thing. To best understand scabies, though, we have to understand how they live, namely their life cycle. The entire active life cycle process of the scabies mite occurs in our skin. This means that they live on our skin, they have sex on our skin, they lay their eggs in our skin, they eat there, they're just living their entire life like a tiny little metropolis. This life cycle, though, includes five main steps. That includes an egg, larva, protonymph, tritonymph, and finally the adult stage. Currently, the length of the life cycle varies quite dramatically in the literature and ranges from 7 to 40 days. While the reason for the vast difference in the reported duration of their life cycle is kind of unknown, it's been speculated that it really comes from the fact that there's a lot of variation in experimentation. This can include differences in how their days were counted, the methods of the studies, the hosts that they were on, thinking of some people did it on humans and other people did it on animals, and finally the varying temperature and relative humidity conditions that have a very big impact on their ability to survive. Generally, though, I feel like 1 to 2 weeks is a pretty good rule of thumb. The scabies life cycle begins when the female burrows into the host's skin and lays her eggs in the upper stratum corneum in their tiny little burrows. These ladies lay between 2 to 3 eggs a day, with about 10% of their eggs making it to adulthood, which isn't the best survivability, but also that's a lot of eggs. And for some level of context, these scabies eggs are actually completely massive when you compare them to the female, with each one being approximately half the female's length. If you take that equivalency in humans, that would be like us laying an egg let's say the average female is like 5'4". That means that it would be like a 60 centimeter or a 2 foot egg. Like it would be absolutely massive. And they make 2 to 3 a day. So obviously that's using a ton of energy. Once the eggs are laid though, they do eventually hatch only 55 hours later. So about 2 or 3 days. Larvae resemble adult mites, but are small and only have 3 pairs of legs at first. The larvae leave the burrow one day after hatching and move to the skin surface. Here, they will burrow into the intact stratum corneum, which is the very top layer of the epidermis, and they'll be able to get in very, very quickly. These are different burrows, though, than the mother's, and rather are very short and are often referred to as molting pouches because their main goal in that is to get to their next stage. Every 3 days, these larvae are going to repeat the cycle. They are going to come out of their burrow, they're going to wander around, and then go back into a new molting pouch. And this is going to happen 3 times in total. After the final molt, they'll emerge as a beautiful-ish adult. And at this point, both the males and females are ready to mate. Noting that these mites are absolutely completely blind, I really want to understand how they manage to find each other, and the answer seems to be the use of waste products and phenolytic compounds that they exude in and onto the skin. It seems like these compounds function as assembly, attachment pheromones, or sex pheromones in other ticks and mites, and therefore it's hypothesized that they would do the same thing in our dear friends, Cercoptes scabii.
Dang, baby, you smell good. What perfume is that? Oh no, that's just me.
This can most easily be equivalent to how other animals will pee on a tree or poop in order to mark their territory or communicate with one another. So kind of like that, but itsy bitsy and a little bit less cute because it's happening in your skin. It seems that by using the signaling, the males are able to find the females when they're in their final molting pouch and they penetrate into the pouch to impregnate her. The romance of mites just getting jiggy with it. And very interestingly, copulation occurs only once during the entire lifetime of the female, and that's enough for her to make eggs for the rest of her life. Oh, and then, as happens with most species, the males just die because their only purpose is to copulate, which is kind of funny. The impregnated females then wander around the surface of the skin, looking, trying to just find that perfect spot where she is going to be able to lay her eggs. While on the skin surface, they hold onto the skin using their sucker-like pulvillae that are attached to those 2 frontmost hands, and that's why they are specially adapted. Once they find that perfect spot that they can just put up that white picket fence and call home, they begin to make their characteristic serpentine burrow, laying their eggs in the process. Personally, I found one of the most interesting parts of reading about the scabies mite being how efficiently they can actually enter the host skin and create these burrows. Mites placed on the skin secrete a clear fluid, presumably a proteolytic saliva, that forms a pool around the body. It appears that this saliva then functionally dissolves the stratum corneum and the skin cells below it, resulting in the mite almost sinking into the skin. As that happens, they simultaneously are doing this digging, crawling, swimming motion that allows them to go in further and further. This swimming allows for the mites to move forward and begin to create that tunnel or burrow. And the time it takes for this to happen is actually really, really fast. For females who are fresh and healthy, it takes them about 20 minutes to enter into the skin. In contrast, for the males or the nymphs or the larvae, it can take as little as 5 minutes because they're much, much smaller. Interestingly, when examining the burrowing behavior of mites, it appears that they continuously actually burrow downwards towards the dermis to maintain the location at the interface of the stratum lucidum and stratum granulosum. And while knowing all the layers of human skin probably isn't going to be super relevant to this discussion, I just want to go over it like super quickly. So human skin is made out of 3 main layers. And going from the top to the bottom, that is the epidermis, the dermis, and at the very bottom, the hypodermis. The hypodermis is basically just connective tissue and fat, which is kind of boring. The dermis is once again connective tissue, but also has a lot of blood vessels, so functions to provide a lot of nutrients. And finally, the epidermis is where we will focus today, because that's where the scabies mites live. So the epidermis is made out of five different layers. At the very bottom is the stratum basale, which is the deepest portion of the epidermis. And here is a whole bunch of cells that are just super, super actively proliferating. I'm sure you might have heard that your skin cells turn over really, really rapidly, especially when you're young, and that's very true. So the stratum basale is where the basal cells are, and these guys basically just actively proliferate, pushing the cells above them up. As those cells get pushed up further and further, they become flatter and flatter. And that is kind of where the other names come from. So above the stratum basale is the stratum spinosum, then the stratum granulosum, the stratum lucidium, and finally the stratum corneum, which is the most superficial portion of the epidermis. So going back to the mites, when I was talking about that, they're going to go down and through that most dead layer, which is the stratum corneum, and they like to sit in between the stratum lucidum and stratum granulosum. So I like to think of them kind of being in the middle of the epidermis. And you might be asking, why put all that effort into digging more than you need to? Isn't that wasting energy? And the answer to that is not really, because as I said before, your skin's constantly turning over. If they don't keep digging, there's a chance that they'll get sloughed off with the skin. And that's the last thing you want for yourself or your eggs to get basically scratched away. So by picking that spot that's kind of in the middle of the epidermis, they're able to stop themselves from being removed. And that way they can actually stay and keep you infected for longer, which is pretty cool. Finally, this area is going to have the last thing they need to survive, which is their source of food. And the mites actually ingest intracellular fluid known as lymph, which is that clear fluid that comes out when you squeeze a pimple out for just a little bit too long before it bleeds. And the way they get access to that is that it really seeps into their burrow as they dig. Therefore, by digging deeper where the cells are still alive rather than them being completely dead in the stratum corneum, they're going to gain access to better lymph fluid. And that's pretty cool because it means that they have access to a really, really good nutrition source. And if you're wondering how they figured out that this is what these mites eat, they actually did it through looking at mites that were freshly removed from humans. And what they found is that in their esophagus and their midgut was IgG antibodies from humans.
Which suggests that they were eating something that would have IgG antibodies in it, i.e. lymph.
By looking at this, as well as examining that inside of the mites, they didn't really have a good repertoire of enzymatic activities to be able to digest anything else, they figured they were on a serum diet, also known as lymph. As like a very, very itsy bitsy aside, I want to talk a little bit about what serum is. Serum is a very important part of human blood and is basically what bathes the white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, and other clotting factors that make it red. And honestly, it's the reason that blood is, well, such a nutritious and amazing meal. Human serum is a mixture of hormones, minerals, proteins, electrolytes, and carbon dioxide. And that basically makes it a pool of all of the nutrition that any organism could ever want. And they get it for the price of almost nothing. They don't have to digest it like we do. They don't have to gather it like we do. They just suck it in. So I always like to think of it as almost the boost of the animal world because it's just an amazing nutritious source. And that's really why so many animals like to consume it, because it is just so, so good.
Why pick a snack that drains you when a goose sustains you? Yeah, indeed, you need a heart, but a shoulda, coulda, woulda had a boost.
Back to the scabies life cycle, because we are almost done that. Once the female has established her burrow, she begins to live in it and laying eggs once again. She's going to migrate down about 0.5 to 5 millimeters per day, which really isn't that long. And it characteristically has this very cool, almost snaking motion because she doesn't move directly forward. And generally, she's just going to lay her eggs along that pathway and they're going to hatch. And then we end up right back at the beginning of that life cycle while her children
will hatch and emerge and move forward. With how important humans are to Cercoptes scabii, it's very natural for the next question to be, how do they find us? How do they seek us out? Do they have anything special that they do? And the answer is actually yes. These guys have adapted ways to find us when they get dislodged or sloughed off of our bodies, and they use a few different methods. How they exactly seek out hosts is actually pretty cool, noting that these little infectious hellbugs are, well, completely blind. Experiments conducted using the dog variety of scabies mites shows that when female mites are placed on thin metal wire that is positioned pointing towards the host at varying distance from the host, they'll actually walk towards the host along the wire, which I think is pretty cool because it shows that they are demonstrably attracted to the host in some way that we might just be able to figure out. So, after this initial experiment, the scientists were like, okay, we're on something here. So they decided they wanted to try out a few different things. The first was if they were going to react to a thermal stimuli. So are they sensing the body heat coming off of the organism? And then the next was if they were detecting the host odor. So is it something that the host is emitting? And then finally, if they were sensing the actual CO2. So were they sensing that there was just a living creature that had a metabolism that was exuding CO2. So when they did the study, they found that the mites, when they were placed up to 11 centimeters away from any heat source, would respond to it. And the vast majority would migrate towards the heat source when they were 6 centimeters away. Interestingly, though, when they tried to sense if it was because of carbon dioxide, what the animals were breathing out, it seemed to have no difference. And when they were placed at very equal distance between a rabbit and a heat stimuli, they couldn't tell the difference. See, but then the scientists thought a little bit harder, and they were like, huh, maybe they're getting confused. If I'm breathing out, there's going to be a little circle around me that has lower CO2. And therefore, if they are just 6 centimeters away from a heat stimuli or a dog on either side, it's going to be confusing. There's going to be too many mixed signals for them to detect anything and actually move along that concentration gradient. So they actually solved that problem. The scientists scrubbed the air of CO2 and the heat source was removed. And then the mites were put there again. And what they found after doing all this work was that the mites did favor the host's odor, which suggests that this was also functioning as another part they were able to detect. So it turns out that when they're seeking out a host, it seems as though they're using heat, odor, and potentially other things, which shows actually quite a bit of sophistication in their evolution to be attracted to their specific host, if that's a human, or a dog, or a cat, or whichever creature it is. Oh, and if you're wondering just how fast the mites were actually moving, the answer is actually only 15.4 centimeters in an hour, so definitely not a cheetah, but able to migrate pretty fast when you consider the fact that a lot of transmission happens from sharing beds or being with close skin-to-skin contact for some level of time. And finally, we couldn't talk about an infectious agent without talking about how they are transmitted. And specifically, when we're considering what allows them to continue to be infective over time. As I said before, the scabies mites aren't always going to be on a human host, and that means that there has to be something that influences their ability to remain infective when they're taken off of one. Multiple studies have shown that it's definitely not a short period of time that they can be off the host, and a lot of it varies based on the humidity and the temperature of the surrounding environment. One study showed that 80% of females that were held off a host for 36 hours at 75% room humidity and 22 degrees Celsius could actually readily penetrate the skin within an average of only an hour and a half. And just drawing back to before, for comparison, live human scabies mites that were taken from bed linens slept in by heavily infected patients could actually start to penetrate the skin in only 10 minutes and be fully embedded in 30, which means that you are seeing some level of loss of fitness from being off the human host, but it's not enough to actually stop infection.
These findings together found that scabies mites have a pretty good survival off the host and show a strong potential that there can be transmission that isn't just skin to skin, but rather is happening through a third object known as a fomite. So then how do we get rid of these guys? If, let's say, they infest someone that we love, well, freezing might be an option that is very, very capable of killing scabies mites. Another one is obviously laundering. One study showed that freezing the dog version of scabies at negative 25 degrees Celsius for an hour and a half resulted in 100% mortality, although after only 1 hour, 23% of the mites survived. So that kind of shows that longer is probably always better. But it is also important to note that negative 25 degrees Celsius is way colder than your fridge gets at home, with most freezers actually sitting at a cool negative 18 Celsius. Alternatively, if you're more of a kill them with fire kind of a person.
Oh my God, that's a big one. It deserves to die. Kill it with fire.
You can go on the opposite side of the temperature scale. And this strategy is really focusing on the fact that they're not very good at hydrating themselves using ambient air. Therefore, laundering and putting softer items through the dryer has been shown to be a good way to eliminate scabies, as this is that fine mixture of both dry and hot that will do them in. These findings overall point to a need of both a moderately tempered, which means around a cushy 20 degrees Celsius, and a humid climate for the mites to survive and be able to cause disease for the next person if they are caught off of their host. And that's it for the first part of our exploration of the disease scabies. We learned all about what a mite is, their life underneath our skin, and how they truly need humans to survive. Next episode, we'll cover all of the symptoms and the epidemiology of the infection, so get ready for that, hopefully coming out in the next 2 weeks. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode today. I really hope that you learned something new and enjoyed coming on this journey with me. If you want a bit more, you can find the show notes at infectiouscast.com or connect over Twitter and Instagram at infectiouscast's handle. Finally, if you want to contact me directly, feel free to shoot me an email at infectiouspodcast@gmail.com. And finally, as a thank you for sticking through all of this, let's hit you with the completely unrelated fun fact that we all love. Because why not? And this one is about our dear friend the vulture. You may have noticed that vultures are kind of experiencing a bit of premature balding, and maybe you've wondered why. Well, let me fill you in. It turns out that vultures lacking feathers on their face is actually quite purposeful. And the reason? Well, turkey vultures have no feathers on their head in order to keep themselves clean as they stick their head inside of carcasses to scavenge and eat. I know, it's pretty cool. Anyways, thanks for sticking to the end, if you did. I hope that you take the time today to smile at someone, give a compliment to that wonderful person who helped you pack your groceries or gave you a coffee this morning, or even just to call your mom and say hi, because being positive and making the world a better place is definitely infectious, but in the absolute best way. Take care.